Alan Kring Productions, in association with Emergent Light Studio, presents the Illinois State Collegiate Compendium, academic lectures in business and economics. This is Business Finance FIL 240 for spring semester 2026.
Today, capital budgeting decision making. This will be your last spreadsheet dependent topic for the semester. And as I sent you in an announcement, the quiz I moved from today until Wednesday, hoping that you'll all do well on it. And thinking about something else I was going to bring up. Primarily, the quiz is stock valuation and also possibly a little bit on weighted average cost of capital. But moving here to the I got it to the look at the numbers for the day. You have Asia. If you look at this, it was kind of an odd thing because you have the Hang Seng and the Nikkei. Both did exactly opposite things. The Nikkei rose and then took the route back down, finished just a little bit up, 0.5%. And then the Hang Seng did the opposite thing. It fell and then it came back up. And so whichever way you want to look at it, the markets kind of ended up fairly close to where they began. Even Australia ended up only about 0.25% above where it started. So it was kind of a not anything important day. And then you had going on in Europe was about the same. It was down through the day, and DAX, CAC, Euronext, they all came back. They didn't quite get back to where they started, but they all had a down, and then they started recovering. So there wasn't anything. The FTSE actually did break above zero towards the end of the day, but it wasn't anything spectacular anywhere. We come over to our side of the world, and as you can see, the Dow just barely up a little bit, 0.25%, S&P 500 up a little more, and then the NASDAQ up not much more than that. So there's a pretty quiet day on the in the financial markets, but the real action comes down here. The excitement we have now, the odd situation of crude oil, the average of all crudes, above the best crude, Brent. But they're still way up there, 112 for the average and 109 for the Brent. And that will get worse over the next few weeks. And so you should see gas prices get back up there around $4, if not a little higher, before too long. And it may get even worse. It's a speculative situation, but the main way that oil gets out of the Middle East is through the Persian Gulf. And that means it's got that choke there in the Strait of Hormuz, which is under siege right now. Another place where there are goods and oil comes through is over in the Suez Canal, and that is under threat. So if that closes down or becomes less safe for transport out of the area, out of the region, we have probably, you'll see gas, oil prices making it up into the 130 range, but we're not there yet. So keep your fingers crossed that this won't billow out and turn, expand even further, this war. But I would not be too optimistic about oil prices coming down in the near future, because the engagements we've had like this before, where you heard, oh, a couple of weeks it'll be over. The last one, Iraq, lasted years and years. And before that, we had a couple of other ones, Vietnam, where it was going to last a few weeks, a few months, and it protracted. And this one's worse because a lot of the things we're dependent upon that are like oil are in danger of being disrupted. So anyway, that's where we are sitting right now. But if you look overall at the sector map here, you notice that it was actually a mildly bullish day. Overall, it wasn't one of those reds everywhere day. You had most of the sectors showing that they're okay for the time being. And so that's something to kind of give us a little heart light in our hearts. But I want to show you a couple of things. I've passed this sector a few times, but I did want to show you something interesting that's going on. Restaurant industry is actually not a single industry. It's got all these different parts to it, at least a few different parts. You have the casual dining, formal dining, you have the fast food, then you have sort of specialty sectors like the pizza sector, and they all kind of have their own mind. There's not a way that they all go. And fast food sector has, I've shown you before with a couple of stocks. One of them I want to show you right now was Wendy's, which has fallen on really bad times. But have a look at what Wendy's did today. Up a whopping 3.5%, almost 3.5%. That is outstanding. And that's a good sign for the rest of the industry overall, is that the fast food sector has been largely under siege. And you see the different companies doing their best to bring new products to the market, to revive their brand with things like new value meals or a new burger, like Burger King has done. McDonald's has got a new burger out there. And they're trying their best to revive their part of the industry. And apparently Wendy's is there doing something kind of cool right now. Now, in the broader industry, you can look at these holding companies that have different chains of restaurants in their portfolio. One of those is Darden. And I show you these just to expose you to different possibilities for investments. For you to consider. Now, Darden is down a little bit today, and it's not down a lot, but notice that it is not doing so well. And look over the year to date, and you can see that there has been, look, you see that trend downward? See the tops trending downward and the bottoms trending downward? That's not a good sign. Now, from a technical analyst's point of view, you see declining tops and declining bottoms. And so I would be careful about thinking that that would be a good place to invest. Even though its beta is very low, comparatively speaking, it's definitely a less risky investment. But that doesn't mean that it's not going to decline in price. And that chart worries me a lot. Now, notice that it does have a decent dividend, though, and its EPS is definitely flagging that it is undervalued. But the question is, how long will it take for that price to start rising so the EPS comes more into where it should be? We don't know, but right now, it's one of those where that's a little scary, seeing declining tops and declining bottoms. In other words, every time it comes up, it's less than the last time it came up. And every time it goes down, it's down more than it was the time before overall. So that's a worry to an investor, especially if you're into technical analysis. Another one we can look at in the holding companies, broad-based holdings of restaurant chains, is Yum Brands. And so you see here, Yum is up very well today, which is sort of contrary to what Darden did for the day. Look at that. What the heck was that? Let me look at the year to date. Now, look at that. Do you see how those declining tops and the declining bottoms, that's the old technical analyst in me just kind of yeah, I'm looking at numbers that are otherwise, you know, the beta is very low. It's definitely undervalued, but still it just keeps, every time it goes up, it doesn't make it as far as it did the last time. And every time it goes down, it seems to want to go down more than it did the last time. And so that visual trend, it has weight. If you're thinking about things like this, that should have some weight in your considerations. Now, if you have a really serious break to the upside, in other words, this declining line, if you see it break through there and stay through there, then that's something that you should say, okay, it's broken that curse that was on it for the past few months. And then it becomes more interesting as a buy. If you see it break, what we call break to the upside. If you see that and it stays there, if it doesn't just test it up there and then chicken out and run back down, that's kind of like one of those signals that is one we take a little bit seriously and say, okay, maybe we should throw a few bucks into a few shares of this company. Now, just to show you where the money is right now, we go back to one of our favorite war companies, Lockheed Martin. And of course, it's up 1.75%. And that's, you know, war is good business. If you want to look here, look at the year to date. See what happened? The war rumors started at the beginning of the year, and it just climbed. Now it's holding its own. It's a little bit down for the day, down past few months, but a few weeks, I should say. But there's definitely investment possibility. Wherever there is war, there is money to be made. And remember that war is a business. From our perspective, it's a business, and there's always some place where business is good. And right now, business is very good. So always keep in mind that your ethical or moral feelings, setting those aside, yeah, you can't beat a war to make a war stock go up. Depressing as that may be. Let me take you to capital budgeting decision making. And I'll tire you a little bit with the background. We have to decide whether to accept or reject new project proposals. Now, that project might be a new factory, a new machine, a new snack that you buy at the grocery store. It might be a new direction in a new car model, a new advertising campaign. They are all projects. They're going to cost money, or technically capital, to start them, with the hope that after that initial punch of capital, they will start generating positive free cash flows. This is not a modern problem. This problem is as old as the ages. And it began to take on a lot of significance in a somewhat more modernistic sense with the introduction of mercantilism and capitalism. When we get to the end of the Middle Ages and we begin to step into the Renaissance, because the Black Plague had wiped out so many people, anywhere from a quarter to a third of the population of Europe and Great Britain, that something interesting happened that we see other times. The survivors of a great apocalypse actually have a taste to dump the old ways and start doing something new, to be something new, to try new things. They are no longer encumbered by a set of old societal, religious, or whatever rules. They want something new and different. Now, there had been a lot of trade, not a lot, I shouldn't say that. There had been trading between Europe and the Far East along the Silk Road, as it was called. But that was a brutal journey of thousands of miles. You had bandits, you had wild animals, you had weather, unspeakable weather, It was unpleasant, long, and it was not a very good guarantee that you would ever be seen again. And the taste for this kind of what's over there mentality began with a couple of explorers who actually took a very dangerous trip back down to the center of the now gone Roman Empire. They went down there to see the ruins and tell everyone about how it looks with all these ruins around. But when they came back, they were saying something very different. They were saying, Rome isn't dead. It's come back to life. There are these artists who are doing absolutely amazing things, realistic paintings of real things, not just people, stick figures looking up in the sky with halos around their heads. They're doing real paintings. Sculptors are actually sculpting nude people with all their muscles proudly showing. Literature about love and death and questioning your religion and all of that is right. They're doing this down there. Oh, you should see it. Well, that got everyone all stirred up. Oh boy, we need more of that. And that's when the explorers started saying, okay, we need to get a fast route over to Asia, over to the Far East. So we are going to go around that ocean to China. No, they didn't believe the world was flat. Hardly anybody did at that time. They did see it as risky AF. You're going to get on boats and you're going to go over an ocean. We've never done that before. God knows what kind of monsters are waiting for us in that ocean. But they said that is a faster route. And we can load up on big ships with whatever we can buy over there and bring it back for everyone to buy from us. Well, there's a problem with that, of course. It was going to cost a huge amount of money to start this, a capital investment of ridiculous proportions. Well, the explorers, they were asking for the royalty, the nobility of different countries. You got money? Mostly they didn't. They were, although they had lavish palaces and, you know, gold jewelry and jewels and all that, they actually didn't have a lot of capital. They were fairly insolvent, a lot of them were. Or at least they were certainly not going to give up the money they had. So they started looking for investors, private investors. Well, this was a time when these families were starting to rise. Guilds for beer, guilds for plumbing, guilds for masonry. And there were also families that were controlling the salt mines around Europe and all this. So they started going up to them and saying, you got some money? We'd like to do this. And here's what we can bring back. Well, that got interest because these were basically capitalists. They said, okay, you're saying that if I give you X number of whatever currency, you can bring back within a year or 2 years this X plus an insane amount of money. And they say yes. Well, there were quite a few of these prowling around. Christopher Columbus, actually his brother, was really going everywhere trying to scare up some money. Chris himself kept begging the Queen of Spain, and she gave him some. But he actually, his brother, I think it was his brother, made a deal with a rich, powerful family in Italy, it was, I think. And the head of the family said, okay, we'll do this. We will fund one of the ships. You want three? We'll fund one of them completely. But we want to I want to be the commander of that ship. And they said, it's cool, yeah, whatever. And so they were beginning to get money from these, but here's the problem. These weren't stupid people. They had already had the experience of understanding investment, capital in, free cash flow out, all that kind of fun stuff. So they weren't interested in just a bunch of wild stories. They wanted numbers. and they wanted a serious way that they could determine whether a project would be a go or a no-go. Do we accept or do we reject this proposal from these explorers? The first one that they, the way that it was done. Now, there are three methods out there. Two are very modern. They're the ones that I teach you so that you can go out there into the business world and spread this gospel of the scientifically, mathematically, logically correct ways to decide. But this old method, the first of the methods, the old one that was used long, long, long ago, is called the payback period method. It's simple and it seems reasonable, logical even, to use this method. The problem is that it's got two major flaws in it, but it worked for centuries as the way to decide yes or no to a project. And interestingly enough, a survey done a few years ago of thousands of businesses around the U.S. asking about which of the three methods do you use? An appalling 25% or something like that still use the payback period method. This medieval early Renaissance method is still alive and well. And I even heard some banter about how this it being used in a company in Peoria, a fairly large company. They were laughing at some young man who didn't know how to decide whether they should buy this new machinery or not. And they said, it's simple, you just do this. And I was sitting there at the dinner thing, listening, that's payback period method. Of course, I didn't say anything negative because they were paying for my dinner, but still, let me show you how it works. It's actually very simple. You have your year and your free cash flow. Okay, let's say that in year zero, this is the year of the initial investment. It's going to be, let's say, $50,000. Now in year one, the project pulls in $4,000. Year two, it's beginning to pick up speed and it pulls in, let's say, $12,000. In year three, as market acceptance and market share grow, it pulls in $25,000. And in year four, it pulls in another, oh, let's say it pulls in another $35,000. And then in year five, it begins to lose its speed and it's back down to $15,000. And then the year that it terminates, it pulls in another $2,000. However, and for heaven's sakes, remember this, get it in your notes. Projects have what is called salvage value. Now, salvage value can be positive or negative, and it has different pieces to it. When I finish a project, I don't just walk away. I sell the stuff that I used in it. You can get some scratch for that. But there are also costs of closing down a project. The most significant these days for a lot of companies is environmental remediation. So, I mean, you could sell the equipment for, you know, you're using the project for $20,000, but remediation might cost you $50,000. So the salvage value might be negative $30,000. But whatever it is, you add that to the last year of the project. It's not a seventh year in this case. It's just part of the project. Let's say the salvage value comes out to be $3,000. So you add that there to get a total of $5,000. So you don't use the 2000. You use that last year plus the salvage value. That's where most people will get this problem wrong on a quiz or an exam. They'll get it wrong because they put the salvage value as a seventh year or an additional year. It's not. It is added to the last year of the project. Okay, so now, the company's payback period is, let's say, 4 years. So let's go through this. I'll put this 5,000 back where the 2,000 was. We start out that in the hole 50,000. After a year, we pulled in 4,000, so we're now still in the hole only 46,000. Another year of positive, we're now in the hole with the extra 12,000. We're now in the hole down to 32,000. And now we go into the next year with another positive 25,000, and we're now in the hole 7,000. The next year we pull 35 grand, which makes us very happy, so we're up 28,000. Another year we're up 15,000 more, so we're up 43,000 total. And finally, in the last year, we're up $51,000. Here's how it works. Payback period is 4 years. That means that this project has to pay for itself in 4 years or less. Well, if we look, in 4 years, it has. So we accept the project because it covered itself in fewer than 4 years. That's how it works. You can see how simple this way is. It's logical. It takes just simple arithmetic to do it. That's why for centuries it was the way of choice. That's how you did it. And it seemed very mathematical. It was sort of like the trend of the Enlightenment, looking at things by the numbers and all of that. Unfortunately, it has two flaws. The first flaw is that it doesn't recognize time value of money. That money, those free cash flows out there year one and after that, they are not in the same units of time as the negative 50,000. You'd have to take their present values to make them comparable to the 50,000. I'd have to take, for the first year, I would have to discount that $4,000 back 1 year. And I would have to discount the next one, 12,000, back 2 years in order for them to be in the same time or temporal units, as it were, as the original amount. Now, you can do that. There is the discounted payback period method. But the most damning flaw of this is that 4 years. When I was a consultant, I did a lot of small companies that had people who were maybe high school or had a community college education, and they'd give me a payback period. They were using payback period. And I would ask, okay, where did that 6-year payback period come from? Or where did that 3-year payback, where do you get that? And they would look at me like, well, that's what we use. Why? Where are you getting that number? Well, that's what we've always used, and that's what, you know, my dad ran this business, that's what he did. There was not a scientific, defensible reason for the years. It was 2, 3, 5. There was one 8 years I did a company. There isn't a reason for it beyond, well, that's just how we do it. And that is its most critical flaw of all, is that it requires that you just say something like magic. Now, let me take you over here in your files folder in Canvas. If you go to your files in Canvas, and the NPV and IRR. Open it up. Now, the first sheet, what I want you to do is, once you open it up, go to the second sheet. Oops, I did the wrong one. Let me take that back and pull up. There you go. Now, go to the second sheet, because there I do the payback period method. The problem with the payback period method, mathematically, it's an arithmetic thing, is that a lot of times you'll cross the zero between 2 years, and that'll drive you crazy. The book gives you this arithmetic thing. You add them up and divide by something, and I make it a lot easier because I just put it right in. I just bake it in so that your spreadsheet, the payback period, let me put this one in here. It was negative 50,000, wasn't it? Negative 50. And then we were up 4,000 for the next year. Read them to me. Then we were up 12,000. Next one. 25,000. Next one. 35,000. And then the last year, 15,000. And then 6 years, let me put in a 6 here, and that was 5,000. Okay. And as you can see, it actually calculates to 2 decimal places how many years it was. And it will find it, it will pop up the year, and in this case, it was 3.26 years. In other words, about 3 years and 4 months, or no, 3 years and 3 months. And this just saves you that pain of figuring out how far between the 2 years it was. Now, the next one is, there are 2 modern methods that are used by, shall we say, the educated class, you guys. We have one called the net present value. And another one called the internal rate of return. Oddly, these are both scientifically, mathematically, financially sound. However, one of them is actually a little stronger than the other. The one that's, and that is unfortunately the one that's the more popular of the two. The net present value is solid as a rock. It just gets you a number. If it's negative, you say, reject the project. If it's positive, you say accept the project. The internal rate of return method has a couple of weaknesses in it. One of them can be corrected with a ridiculously complicated little trick with the math. But the other problem with it is that there is a subjective place in it at the end. However, we use both of them, and like I said, the internal rate of return method is the more popular of the two methods. However, I show you the net present value approach first. Your first worksheet, NPV IRR, is where the action is. Now that graph, you can delete that graph if you want. It's just sort of a visual helper, but it kind of confuses people more than it helps them. But let me show you how it works. Is that I'm going to put in these free cash flows. Year zero, your initial investment is $50,000. Year one, it generates $8,000. Year two, $15,000. Year three, $15,000. Year three, $10,000. And in year four, the free cash flow plus the salvage value is $20,000. Now, let me take a discount rate. Now, you'll need a discount rate. There are two ways that you can companies could go. They could get a discount rate using the capital asset pricing model. They look at this project and they say, all right, what is the beta of companies that do this project, and in other words, comparables, and get a CAPM result and put that in there. The more popular way, which is not good at all, is the weighted average cost of capital. They use that for the discount rate for the cash flows. The real big problem with that is that WACC is the overall risk of the company as a whole. It might not be anywhere close to the risk of this project. You might have the company have a WACC of 8.5%, but this project is very safe. It could have a WACC maybe of 6%, or it might be a very risky project and have a WACC of 12%. But the WACC is oftentimes the one that is used for the discount rate. And in this case, let's take a discount rate for these cash flows of 5%. And we get a negative net present value. Let's take a discount rate of 4%. I'm going to have to change this. Something is not quite good on this one. I'm going to put in a fifth year of this project. I'm going to leave that 20, and I'm going to put in a fifth year of $12,000. Okay. Yeah, I'll put in one more year. Okay, let's take 5% again. We have a positive net present value. So the project is we accept the project. Let's try 6,000. 6%, I'm sorry. It's still got a positive NPV. Let's go up to 10%. Oh, it's negative there. Go back down to 9%. Still negative. 8% positive. Notice, by the way, that as you increase the discount rate, the NPV drops. As I go to 8%, it's down to an NPV of a little over 1,000. As I go to 9%, the NPV is negative. So somewhere between 8% and 9%, the project goes from positive NPV to negative NPV. That's important, because if I were to draw a graph of this, say NPV on the vertical axis, say 1,000, 2,000, 3,000, and then down below, negative 1,000, negative 2,000, negative 3,000, and use discount rates of, let's say, 1%, 2%, 3%, 4%, 5%, 6%, 7%, 8%, 9%, 10%. Okay. At a discount rate of, what was it, 9%, or let's do 8%. 8%, it was positive $1,000. So here at 8%, it's about $1,000. But at 9%, it's negative $305. It's just a little bit negative. Now, if we connect those lines, those points, rather. Wait a minute, let me do that again. A little steeper. The line that connects them is called the NPV profile for this project. See that place right there? Where it crosses, the discount rate crosses. That is called the internal rate of return. The internal rate of return is the discount rate that makes the net present value equal zero. The internal rate of return is the discount rate that makes the net present value equal zero. The internal rate of return is the discount rate that makes the net present value equal zero. That's the one that companies really like. In this case, the internal rate of return, as you can kind of see from there, but it's calculated here, is 8.75%. That's the discount rate that makes the net present value zero. Watch what happens if I put in the discount rate of 8.75%. Well, it's almost zero. A little rounding there. But anyway, that's IRR. Now, let me point out that one, finding NPV by hand with a calculator is a pain in the butt because you have to take each of these present values of the positive free cash flows and add them up and then subtract the initial investment. That can take you a while. Even a financial calculator takes a little minute to figure that out. The internal rate of return is a real pain in the butt because you have to just guess back and forth, find one discount rate where the NPV is positive, then find one where it's negative, and then try closer together points. Back before the calculators and the Excel, the way we would do it is we would get engineering graph paper, a ruler, and a very sharp mechanical pencil. We'd get one, find a discount rate where the NPV was positive, find one where it was negative, and then graph, connect the two points, get the NPV profile, and then we would eyeball where the IRR was. Now, Excel does it for us, and just instantly. All those years wasted. Let me tell you one more thing here. There's something here. Let me go back to trying. Let's do 8%. You see down here this thing called the profitability index? That is actually a shorthand of the NPV. What the profitability index does, it takes the sum of the present values of the free cash flows years one through whatever, and then it just divides it by the absolute value of the investment, initial investment. So if the profitability index is 100% or above, you accept. If it's below 100%, you reject. It's just it is NPV, except in a shorthand notation. And it has gotten really popular over the last some years, because it's, you know, with the NPV, you've got, you show all the free cash flows and you do all that stuff, and you get a dollar number, either a positive or a negative. The profitability index isn't a dollar amount. It's just a number. And that's why it's good, because it's scalable. It's scale independent. So you could look at projects of in the millions of dollars and projects in the ten thousands of dollars, and they'll all have profitability indexes in that percentage range, above or below 100%. It doesn't care about the dollars. So that's one of the reasons is it has become very popular as the decision-making number. Oh, I see 102%. We accept. Yeah, it's above 100%. Now, let me think here. What I'm doing. This is all you have to do. Make sure that you put in the free cash flows accurately, and don't put in the salvage value as another year. You add it to the operational free cash flow of the last year of the project. And it can be positive or negative. Like I said, at the end of a project, you can sell off all of the equipment. Whether or not you do is irrelevant. You're just talking about an opportunity cost if you don't. But you also have negatives, closing down a project, shuttering the buildings, paying the for the layoffs of workers and all that kind of stuff. But the worst one, as I said, on the negative side is the environmental remediation. And that is one that if you ignore it, it'll come back to bite you many, many years later, because eventually people will figure out, oh, we're getting sick, we're getting cancer. And then there will be a class action lawsuit with a settlement in the tens or hundreds of millions of dollars. So you might as well remediate immediately. And that remediation can be cleaning up and replacing topsoil. Another one that's a rather annoying problem is USTs, underground storage tanks, because they can be sitting there and then someone figures out, oh, there's an underground storage tank that used to hold fuel, and that fuel is now leaking into the aquifer. Well, who owned this land before us? Ah, you did. Okay, we're going to sue you. So are all the people getting sick from the gasoline in their water and all that. So yeah, salvage value can have a very nasty negative component to it. You might as well deal with it up front, close a project down, pay what it costs to get rid of that stuff, add the money you get from selling equipment and whatever. Okay. Those are the biggies in the project, in capital budgeting decision making, which, to the relief of many, I can go on to something else now about project decision making. While I'm doing that, why don't you do your attendance in attendance radar? And I'll talk a little about this. In project analysis, we have this kind of mantra about incremental cash flows. Incremental cash flows. What this means is that you consider a project in isolation from the rest of the company. First of all, this project you're considering isn't part of the company. It may become if you accept it, but it is not. You sandbox the project. The free cash flows are those that come from that project and from that project only. The revenues and the costs. Now, there are some cases where there is spillover. You have to be suspicious when you start talking about it, but there are some times when they do happen. In other words, what you're doing in this project will affect revenues and or costs of another of other projects in your company. Now, these externalities come in two flavors, positive, let me put it over here, and negative. Now, on the positive side, we talk about synergies. One example would be, okay, if we were to take this project on, we would order some of the same stuff we do for other projects. And that means that with larger orders, we might get a discount on all of it that we were ordering. So yeah, that might help our costs a little bit. Another synergy is, and this one is intentional in many cases, where we take on a project that has the intent of enhancing revenues from another project. A fabulous example of that is this. You can go to a store like a Best Buy or online to Amazon and get a really nice printer for $79. It's color, it's 300 DPI, it's just beautiful for a price that can't possibly cover the costs of Canon or HP to make those printers. And that's fine with them. In other words, the printer itself is a negative NPV project. But then you are buying ink for the rest of your miserable life. So the printer creates a positive externality, a synergy with the inks that you have to buy with it, for it, rather. HP is probably the best because they even sell paper. Our HP printer works best with HP paper. And you see the synergy there? It's so, in other words, in looking at the NPV of the printer, you have to recognize the positive revenues that spill over on revenues of ink, printers, and all that kind of printer ink and paper and all that. Okay, here's another whole realm of them. Medical devices and medical conditions. A few years ago, I bought a glucose meter, a blood glucose meter. It was cheap. It was like $29. But I also have to buy the test strips that fit only that meter by the alcohol pads. Those evil little things you stick in your finger that hurt like hell in a tiny place and all that. And then if you register your meter, well, they're going to see if you want a subscription for your meal plans, for your exercise routines, for your lifestyle. The same is true with conditions like cancer. Cancer is not a disease in a business sense. It is a lifestyle. So we can sell all these things. The American Psychological Association some years back decided that I'm not Asperger's syndrome. It's really just autism. And suddenly the subscriptions, Autism Quarterly, How You Live a Happy Life with Autism. Subscribe today and be a kind of normal person. It's all lifestyles. You see the synergistic spillovers that happen when you have these kinds of things that are conditions that become subscriptions. There's no longer a shrink wrap. There's a QR code you can click and become part of a cash flow stream beyond just the condition. That's just the reality of how business works. We would prefer free cash flow to a lump of money any day of the week. So understand, synergies do happen, and they are very important. Let me take you to the negative externalities. The worst one of all is cannibalism. Cannibalism is where a new project actually eats revenues from something you've already got going, from projects that are already underway. they are really worrisome. And that's why you will have many companies go so far as to rebrand, change the name on the label so that two products don't eat, one product doesn't eat the other's revenues. Car companies are famous for this. Does anyone know who makes Infiniti cars? Yeah? Bingo, Nissan. They're sure as hell not going to let an Infiniti eat into the revenues of their top-of-the-line Nissan, the Camry. How about Honda? Honda. What's Acura? They don't want Acuras eating the revenues of the top-of-the-line Hondas. This is so obvious. How about Lexus? Who runs Lexus? Yeah, Toyota. Yeah, they are sure as hell not going to let Lexus eat into the profits that they make, the revenues from the top of the line Toyota. Now, anyone seen the new one out there, Genesis? Who is it? Hyundai. Yep. They are not going to let these luxury cars cannibalize revenues from their top of the line of their other models. This is just how they do it. And of course, they also, even within a line of cars, they will follow demographic waves. For example, Toyota with the RAV4, it used to be this really small, just adorable little four-seat SUV. And four seats, you'd all have to be pretty darn skinny to be comfortable in it. But as that demographic grew up and went from their early 20s to their 30s, their 40s, what did they do? They grew up the Toyota RAV4 so they could follow that demographic wave, and then they could slide a new model, cheapo special, down underneath to catch the next demographic wave. All for the purpose of holding on to revenues and not letting car models cannibalize other car models. And there's a lot of advertising, too, that goes into this to create product discrimination, so that people don't see two as being the same. They can keep their revenues of one from eating into the revenues of another. That's cannibalism. So in the context of what I'm teaching today about capital budgeting decision making, the incremental, just what the project itself creates in terms of revenues and costs. However, there are times when we have to do a larger analysis. How does this new project impact revenues of other projects we have and impact costs of projects that we already have? And so in that context, we do have to think about this. However, the subject of project decision-making is at the core of business models, because there's got to be a yes or a no. Whether it's a new factory that you're thinking of putting up, a new product that you're thinking of fielding, a new marketing campaign that you're considering, or any one of a large number of other places where the company decides that it is going to grow and do something new. In some cases, it's yes, but interestingly enough, if the analysis is honest, it's more likely that it will be no. That's all I have for you today. Go home.